this is very puzzling. You know, we're having to produce an awful lot of effort, involve an awful lot of people to figure this one out.
Experts work to figure out what's killing ringed seals in the Arctic. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an investigation of executive pay at nonprofits serving Western Alaska.
Mr. Crow and Mr. Cotter's salaries are far and away above what the other four CDQ groups pay their CEO.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits. From research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production, Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine.
Experts in the U.S. and Canada are still puzzling over what's sickening ringed seals and walrus in the Arctic. Dozens of seals have died from the mysterious disease. A small percentage of walrus are ill with something that looks very similar, but no walrus deaths have been tied to the disease. Several labs in the U.S. and Canada have been unable to figure out what's causing the illness in both species. APRN's Annie Feight has this update.
Kathy Burek-Huntington has done a lot of marine mammal necropsies during her career. The veterinary pathologist has become familiar with the outsides and insides of killer whales, sea lions, and seals, but she's never seen anything quite like the diseased ringed seals she began receiving from Barrow earlier this fall.
It's rather remarkable how many skin lesions they have and how severe the skin lesions are. You know, it's something I've never seen before or read about in seals.
Burek-Huntington says the insides of the diseased animals have been more variable. There's usually a lot of bleeding, swelling, and emphysema in the lungs. Some have obvious problems with their liver. The animals also have bacterial infections, but she thinks they are a symptom of the illness, not the cause. Burek-Huntington has done 10 seal necropsies so far and examined samples from one walrus. She says it's not yet clear if the walrus and ring seals are suffering from the same thing, but she thinks they probably are.
Well, I think it would be very surprising to have, you know, in this one year, a bunch of seals that have ulcers on their skin and a bunch of walruses that have ulcers on their skin, that it would be something different. That seems like a very unlikely coincidence.
Burek-Huntington does most of her work from her Eagle River home. An imposing microscope sits at one end of her small office. On a recent afternoon, she's examining diseased walrus tissue.
So I just have a pile of slides here, and let me show you.
She picks up a small clear slide that holds a tiny cross-section of walrus skin.
So this is a slide of one of those skin lesions. So this is the top of the skin right there. And then this is actually one of the little punched out ulcers. And then you just put it up there on your microscope.
She lets me take a look.
Oh, wow.
What do you think, doctor?
I think it looks kind of pretty.
Yeah, I know. It's a lot of pink and purple.
This microscope often leads Burek-Huntington to the cause of death for an animal. But this case has been more difficult. She thinks the most likely culprit is a virus, but all of the usual viruses that affect seals and walrus have so far turned up negative.
This is very puzzling. It's very frustrating. I mean, wildlife is a special category of disease investigation. You have so much less information on those animals' history. But then this is a kind of a special case in that, you know, we're having to produce an awful lot of effort, involve an awful lot of people to figure this one out.
9 different labs in the U.S. and Canada have been running tests trying to come up with an answer. The latest is a lab that looks specifically for emerging pathogens. Terry Rolls is overseeing the investigation for the National Marine Fisheries Service. She says that lab can test for a much wider range of things.
So it could be something new to these animals, but no, a known entity, or it could be a completely new virus or bacteria that is unknown to science or undiscovered.
Rolls says more than 30 experts are working on the problem. Scientists are also checking in with native communities to determine if anything like this has happened before. Rafaela Stimmelmayer is a wildlife vet with the North Slope Borough.
There are some reports that conditions similar to this has been observed before, but not at this magnitude, and usually not with skin lesions and hair loss in that extent as that we are observing right now.
Stimmelmayer says fall seal hunting near Barrow doesn't begin until next month. She says hunters in the area are aware of the issue and are keeping burrow scientists informed when they encounter a sick seal. Seal hunting has started in the Kotzebue area. Alex Whiting is an environmental specialist with the native village of Kotzebue. He says he hasn't heard reports of ringed seals with lesions in the area, but he says hunters are concerned about it.
If it's just a blip on the radar screen, or if it's going to, you know, stay the same or increase, or we rely on seals heavily in Kotzebue Sound for food, and it's not good to have disease outbreak running through your food populations.
The state of Alaska and federal agencies are recommending hunters avoid harvesting animals that look ill, already a common practice. The guidelines also advise wearing gloves to handle sick animals and making sure all meat is cooked. Mike Brubaker is director for the Center for Climate and Health at the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. He's trying to make sure communities have the best information possible.
People are still really processing what this means, and because there's so many unknowns, it's hard to know how to proceed. And so we think applying a precautionary approach is a good way. And hopefully, before too long, the wildlife community will have some answers as far as what's going on.
Biologists in Alaska are preparing paperwork to declare the mystery an unusual mortality event. That would free up more resources to continue the investigation. But NIMS says a quick answer isn't likely. It may take a year or more to come to a conclusion. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
During the AFN convention in Anchorage over the weekend, Alaska's U.S. Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski brought together officials from both the federal and state Veterans Administration to conduct a Native Veterans listening session. The senators were joined by the Deputy Undersecretary of the VA, John Garcia. He said the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, Eric Shinseki, is committed to bringing the VA into the 21st century using technology for outreach, healthcare, and education.
All the things that you have fought to defend, because I firmly believe, and I know these senators believe, and I've heard them in their committees, that if a man or woman raised the right hand to defend the Constitution of this country, and you're willing to serve on the front lines and bleed and die for it, you best be on the front lines for jobs, education, health care, housing, all the things that you have fought to defend. You've earned it.
Verdi Bowen is the administrator for the Office of Veterans Affairs in Alaska. He said beginning this week, the VA will be going village to village across Alaska to make sure every territorial guardsman has a discharge document. He says this is important to ensure that the military records facility in St. Louis, Missouri has those documents forever.
And the good thing about that is 100 years from now, our children will be able to go and pull those records and see our service. And my goal is sometime by this summer to have 100% of all the Alaska Territorial Guardsmen with their discharges located in St. Louis. And each village will be notified as we complete them if there's any living family members left there so that they can receive those actual discharges. But if there's nobody left, we will have a record completed in St. Louis. And that's a guarantee you have from me.
And then the floodgate of stories opened, and for the next hour, veterans told of struggles with getting VA services because of bureaucracy and because most of those VA services are available only in major hubs or cities like Anchorage, making it expensive and difficult for vets in rural Alaska. A veteran named George from Nome said he'd traveled the country and at one time thought the VA services in Washington, D.C. were the worst in the country, but now, he said, Anchorage has that distinction for him. He told of flying from Nome for an appointment at the VA hospital, misplacing his VA card, and being refused service, even though he was clearly in their system.
There's my picture, there's my face. And they said, you can't be seen. They said, go over to the Native hospital. But let me tell you, I earned my right as a veteran to use the VA system. I did not earn my right to use the Native hospital because I was born into it. I used the VA.
He said he would not go back until he got an apology. It came quickly as Alex Spector, the director of the Alaska VA healthcare system, immediately stood up.
Sir, I'm the director of the Alaska VA, and I apologize to you for the service that we did not provide you. We should have provided you that service. And we'll get together with you after this meeting, get the information, and I'll look into it personally. And I certainly apologize if you were treated that way. That was wrong.
Another veteran tearfully tried to tell of being denied disability benefits for years, finally getting them, only to be told 3 years later that he suddenly owed the VA $24,000. He was so distraught he could not continue speaking. Another vet, Teresa, said after serving in the Middle East, she became sick and finally was diagnosed with cancer. She fell behind on her mortgage payments, and although the bank didn't work with her, she said the VA Loan Servicing Center in Denver told her a loan modification program was in the works for her.
I was told that to hold on to my payment, a modification was being granted. A liquidation appraiser came to my door and informed me that I was being foreclosed on. I stand before you right now as a homeless veteran. In January of 2003, the Alaska State Troopers came to my home and put me and my handicapped daughter and son on our porch. I stand before you homeless. I hold in my hand the regulation, and every regulation was broken when it came to my case.
She said the home still sits empty. The senators listened, and staff took names and information from the veterans. Senator Begich said the benefits veterans earn must be delivered to them at the highest level possible. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a new online news source in Dutch Harbor.
Because of the deadliest catch, Dutch Harbor is interesting to people in faraway places.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
Investigative reports usually get a lot of attention from the public and in the media. But an investigation of executive pay in the Community Development Quota Program that was published in August 2010 in the Alaska Journal of Commerce seemed to slip under the radar. The CDQ program was established in 1992 to help create economic activity in 65 Western Alaska villages. But reporter Andrew Jensen found exorbitant pay for executives at the Coastal Villages Region Fund. For example, CEO Morgan Crow earned $800,000 a year in salary, bonuses, and benefits for 2009. And Jensen found that compensation for the top three executives at Coastal Villages increased last year.
According to the most recent annual report that Coastal Villages put out for 2010, Morgan Crow's total compensation has increased to $805,000. Trevor McCabe's compensation has gone up to $486,000. And Chief Financial Officer Richard Monroe, his salary has gone up to $458,000. So those top three employees are pulling in about $1.7 million just between the three of them.
And what's the annual amount of money that they're, I realize that it probably fluctuates, but what's the average amount that they're dealing with on a yearly basis?
Their revenue from fishing operations, it averages, in terms of gross revenue, it's gone from about $26 million in gross revenue to about $47 million in gross revenue over the last 5 years.
And how do these high salaries compare with the benefits that are being distributed to people in the villages?
Well, the salaries in the case of Coastal Villages are much larger than the community development programs. Since I have updated my my information on this story, for example, the community development grant program for Coastal Villages has gone from about $300,000 to about $500,000 over the past couple years, but that still pales in comparison to the amount that the top three employees alone are making.
What about some of the other CDQ groups? Were you able to determine the pay and salary of some of the other executives?
Yes, I was. They are nonprofit organizations, so they're required to file public tax returns. The second highest paid CEO of a CDQ group is Larry Cotter from Aleutian Pribilof Island Community Development Association, otherwise known as APICTA. And Larry Cotter makes about $355,000 per year. The average salary for the other four CEOs is around $140,000, $150,000. So, Mr. Crow and Mr. Cotter's salaries are far and away above what the other four CDQ groups pay their CEO.
You checked recently to see if there'd been any changes since you first reported on this story over a year ago. What did you find?
What I would say that I found in looking at Coastal Village's most recent information, the main thing that I saw that had changed was the salaries for Trevor McCabe and Richard Monroe, who are the chief operating officer and the chief financial officer for Coastal Villages. Those two, their salaries have gone from, you know, the $250,000 to $260,000 range per year up to $450,000, $480,000 within just a couple years. Morgan Crow's salary has been around $800,000 for the past 3 years, but Trevor McCabe and Richard Monroe's salaries have increased quite a bit by almost $200,000 per person per year over the past 2 years. And the amount that Coastal Villages has spent on compensating its board of directors has also increased quite a bit. Coastal Villages spent $281,000 on their board of directors between compensation, travel, per diem costs, spent $281,000 in 2009, and in 2010, that amount spent on their board of directors increased to $554,000. So in just 1 year, the amount that they spent on their board of directors went from $281,000 to $554,000 per year.
And what are these executives doing? Tell us how the CDQ funds work, how they operate.
The way a CDQ works is there's a number of species in the Bering Sea, halibut, cod, pollock, crab. The CDQ groups, the six organizations that represent 65 villages, they receive 10.7% of the total harvest quota for those species each year. And then what they do is some of them, like Coastal Villages, they own their fishing vessels, and they will go out and fish that quota off their vessels. And then some of the CDQ groups will take that quota and they lease it to other fishing operations, and they are paid a royalty fee.
Morgan Crow wouldn't call you back for this story, but another executive at a CDQ program did. What did you hear in defense of these high salaries?
Well, the one CEO who did defend Morgan Crow's salary was Larry Cotter from APICTA, who is the second highest paid CEO of a CDQ group. And the argument that was made to me by Mr. Cotter from APICTA, and this argument was also made by Richard Monroe from Coastal Villages, was that we are operating in the for-profit world of the seafood industry while we have a nonprofit charitable mission. So their argument is that we need to attract and pay high salaries because we are competing in a profit world in order to serve our charitable mission. But in comparing the salaries at Coastal Villages to the publicly traded Alaska corporations such as, you know, the telecoms, GCI, ACS, North Rim Bank, those organizations, because they're publicly traded, have to disclose their executive compensation, as do the Alaska Native Regional and Alaska Native Village corporations. They have to disclose their executive compensation. And Mr. Crow's salary, as well as his top two lieutenants, Mr. McCabe and Mr. Monroe, their salaries are far and away greater than many of their counterparts, both at Alaska Native companies and at publicly traded companies such as GCI or North Rim Bank.
Andrew Jensen is a reporter with the Alaska Journal of Commerce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, offering nonstop service to Frankfurt from Anchorage and Fairbanks between May and September, with connections to most German and European destinations. Details available at condor.com. The law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska is the number one state in the nation for per capita gun death rates. That's according to a study done by the Violence Policy Center, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit organization. KDLG's Daisha Eaton explains.
The study was based on data from the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's National Center for Injury Prevention and Control. Kristen Rand is the legislative director for the Violence Policy Center, which conducted the study.
It shows that Alaska is number one in the nation for overall gun death, and that includes homicide, suicide, and unintentional gun death, with a rate of 20.64. That's a stunning rate. Any rate over 20. We haven't seen a rate that high in the 4 years that we've been doing that study. So Alaska clearly does have a gun violence problem.
The study says that more than 60% of households in Alaska own guns. The study says that states with higher gun ownership and weak gun laws lead the nation in gun deaths. The five states with the highest per capita gun death rates are Alaska at number one, followed by Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, and Wyoming. Each of these states had a per capita gun death rate far exceeding the national per capita gun death rate of 10.38 per 100,000. All five of those states have lax gun laws and higher gun ownership rates. By contrast, states with strong gun laws and low rates of gun ownership had far lower rates of firearm-related deaths. Ranking last in the study of gun death was Hawaii, followed by Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York, and New Jersey. Rand says it's simple.
States that tolerate more guns just have higher rates of gun death. I mean, there's a direct correlation. Countries like the United Kingdom, which have been very aggressive in regulating firearms, they have extremely low rates of gun death, and they also have very low homicide rates compared to the United States. And we see that pattern repeat here, state by state.
The latest available data from 2008 shows that the total number of Americans killed by gunfire that year was 31,593. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have weighed in on the health effects of fine particulate pollution. Atlanta-based CDC officials were in Fairbanks last night for an air quality forum. CDC Chief of Air Pollution and Respiratory Health Paul Garbey says cardiac problems are the best known impact.
The risks for heart disease, heart attacks and deaths related to heart attacks from particulate matter exposure are fairly substantial in communities that have high particulate matter levels, as has been observed over years of scientific research.
Garbey says fine particulates can also affect asthma. He says it's unknown if the tiny particles, like those in the wood smoke that fouls Fairbanks area during extreme cold, cause asthma, and he says the health effects aren't always temporary.
There can be long-term effects, though, from exposure to high levels of air pollution, but it would take years of observational research to really understand that better.
Garbey and the CDC's Rachel Kossover were among speakers at the state and borough-sponsored forum in Fairbanks. The presentation included previously released data from a study Kossover conducted when she worked for the State Department of Health. It shows increased emergency room visits for heart and respiratory problems when Fairbanks air violates the EPA fine particulate pollution standards. Fairbanks Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins has told members of the Occupy Fairbanks group they can't camp out in Veterans Memorial Park. Members of the local group have been staying at the downtown park for more than a week in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street movement. Mayor Hopkins says borough attorneys informed him the group is violating local code.
I do have to restrict them from camping in the park. There's a process. If they want to continue there, they have to go through Parks and Rec for that for a daily, non-overnight camping.
A few Occupy Fairbanks protesters have been camping overnight in the gazebo at the Veterans Park since October 17th, following a downtown march by a much larger group. Fairbanks police initially ordered them out, but the protesters were granted reprieve while local officials conferred. David Leslie, a UAF student with Occupy Fairbanks, says the group is not out to break the law.
We've been doing everything by the book so far, and we've, you know, made calls and gotten permission, or at least thought we had, and So, this is the first time we've ever reached an impasse like this.
Leslie says the group met last night and decided to maintain a vigil at the park, but no one will be sleeping there. When Alaska Newspapers Incorporated went under, many residents in rural Alaska worried that it would be harder to get local news. Now, one man in Unalaska has decided to do something about this. KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez has more.
For 2 months, Southwest Alaska has been without a newspaper. The Dutch Harbor Fisherman and the Bristol Bay Times were bought up after Alaska Newspapers Incorporated sold off its assets, but they still haven't returned to newsstands. In this void, a new website has popped up, though, the Dutch Harbor Telegraph. It's got photos of local events like the Pumpkin Plunge, an editorial about internet speeds in Unalaska, and a write-up of a safety drill. The man writing, editing, and publishing the Telegraph is actually the Fisherman's former editor, James Mason. He says that it's been a while since he was last in touch with the Fisherman's buyers, and that in the meantime, he decided to go out and see if he could operate a one-man daily publication focusing on community news.
This is sort of an experiment to see what happens. I'm hoping that at some point I'll be able to make some money. If I don't, it's just an experiment in publishing a newspaper online.
Mason's website has been up for about a week, and he's getting about 300 hits a day. Not all of them are coming from Alaska, though. In fact, he's got readers as far as Holland.
Because of the deadliest catch, Dutch Harbor is interesting to people in faraway places.
Mason has one advertiser, but he doesn't have any financial backers yet. Like A&I did with the Fisherman, he's basically swallowing the costs of publishing the Telegraph. Even though no one's paying him, he says he's working on the project.
All day. I mean, I go swimming and I play journalist, basically, and I try to clean my house up.
So what does this mean for the Dutch Harbor Fisherman? According to Jason Evans, not much. Evans is part of a partnership that bought the paper from A&I along with the Bristol Bay Times. He says that they're still looking to combine those papers and publish a print edition.
Our plan is to, you know, print the paper and have it delivered and also follow up with an online presence. So, you know, I admire anyone that wants to jump into the news and provide a service to the community.
Pending any further delays, Evans expects a new iteration of the Dutch Harbor Fisherman to be up and running by next month. In Unalaska, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Dillingham, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, and Dan Bross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
And by
Solstice Advertising, bringing creativity to Alaska businesses and nonprofits, from research and strategy to print, web, and broadcast production. Solstice Advertising, an agency for brands that want to shine. The Federal Aviation Administration sets standards for the operation of aircraft in airports and provides services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska, so when passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. There's more information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska or toll-free at 1-866-357-4704. This message sponsored by the FAA.
You can find APRN headlines and more online at alaskapublic.org. There you'll discover local and worldwide news, upcoming events, and statewide community conversation. alaskapublic.org, connecting you to Alaska one story at a time.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.